Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. If you are looking for something new to listen to, there are lots of other NPR podcasts. There are great interviews, highlights from the week's news, storytelling, and entertainment. And you can browse them all on iTunes under podcasts. Hello there. This is Linda Holmes, and I'm here with Stephen Thompson. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Linda.
We have never done this before in the entire history of Pop Culture Happy Hour.
Are we issuing a correction?
Well, it's not so much a correction. We weren't wrong.
No.
We've just had a late-breaking news development.
Yes.
Fortunately, it's a good late-breaking news development.
You're going to hear us complaining, and it's not going to be valid.
We're still right. No. We're still right in theory. Anyway, you will hear later in this episode a discussion about the shuttering of the website Television Without Pity, where I worked for a really long time. And we talked in this episode about the impermanency of stuff on the internet and the fact that digital things can kind of be zapped out of existence, because when they first said they were going to shutter the site, they said that the archives would go away and you wouldn't be able to access them.
Right.
Right. Which we thought was very sad.
Yes.
In between the taping and the release of this episode, we found out that they've made a change to that decision and they're keeping the archives online. So we didn't want to be giving you the information that you would no longer be able to find all this stuff when, in fact, you will be able to find
it. You will, but the forums
are
still going away.
First of all, the forums are still going away. And for a lot of people, the forums were a huge part of their experience there as well. But it still speaks to how capricious this
yes.
is, right? Earlier in the week, hundreds of thousands of pages of writing were going to go away, and now they're not. And that's great, but it feels a little random.
It's great, but it is still an important reminder of all the things I complain about in this episode.
It's true. It does still give you a little bit of a sense of that you've gotten a reprieve from a very dangerous, you know, mastermind.
An incredibly unjust ruling
yeah.
Was overturned.
Exactly. Unjust ruling was overturned. So as you listen to this episode, just be aware we had a reprieve from the disaster of the archives going away. But everything we say about the fact that the archives could have gone away
yep.
is still true. So enjoy the episode. And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we dive into the world of superheroes for the first time this season with Captain America, the Winter Soldier. Then, as one of us says goodbye to an old stomping ground, we'll talk about the impermanence of the internet and what happens when parts of it go poof. And as always, we'll close with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Matt Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am the director of Vertical Initiatives and Mischief, which involves running our code switch team and starting two new verticals covering education and global health.
That's a lot of stuff, Matt Thompson. And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website, and don't get involved with verticals.
Yeah.
Whatever the hell they are.
Well, you know, you can't stay away forever from the lingo.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Especially
we'll
when you're around Matt. Matt knows all the lingo.
Gotcha.
He's doing all the fun stuff. Speaking of fun stuff, you know, very often when we come to you on this podcast, we are talking about the movies that opened perhaps a week before you hear it.
Mm-hmm.
We are talking
oh
on this podcast today about
so
Captain America, the Winter Soldier, which is coming out on the day that this podcast drops.
Yeah.
Isn't that shocking?
None of this coming out a week after something has already flopped.
We're all about currency. We are all about currency. So, as you may recall, 2011, there was Captain America, the first Avenger, they
uh-huh.
called the subtitle. And then, of course, Cap showed up in The Avengers,
uh-huh.
as we know. And now he is back in Cap 2, as I have called it in my head. So in this movie, what you see in short is that Captain America is confronted with the Winter Soldier, this sort of ambiguously identified, terrible, frightening assassin who is suddenly running around doing all kinds of things. And there's a whole plot that involves the integrity of S.H.I.E.L.D. and a bunch of other stuff. And it calls back to the first movie in certain places. He also spends a lot of the time in this movie with Black Widow, played by Scarlett Johansson, and he meets a Falcon, played by Anthony Mackie, who really needs to be the guy in more movies and the other guy in fewer movies,
yeah,
in my personal opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to go to Glenn.
Uh-huh.
What did you think about Captain America, the Winter Soldier?
You know, I reviewed the first one back in 2011 for NPR, and there I was There I was struck by their performance of Chris Evans, who I remember arguing with certain people that, you know, they thought he got lost in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he was doing something pretty subtle with a very vanilla, straight-ahead character.
Right.
But I think the physicality of the role was so distracting because he, in the first part of it, he played, you know, basically a lollipop with hair.
Right.
And then he has very distracting, comical muscularity.
He does.
That can may kind of take your eye off the ball. And then...
I'm not sure you found it entirely comical.
Yeah, but I do think he was giving you a little bit of what he had to, which was this is a character of 1940s values,
right?
In the modern day. That's the tension. And even though the original film wasn't really set in the modern day, in a film like The Avengers, you bring him into conflict with somebody like Tony Stark, mm-hmm. Iron Man, and you flesh out this character. But I thought he did have a certain wistful sadness to him in the first movie. I do think he gets lost here. I do think that there's just, the action is so repetitive that we don't really get a deep dive into the character. I didn't understand what the film was going for, because the first movie was clearly a war film. That was the infrastructure of it.
Right.
And it reminded you of things like Guns of Navarone or Where Eagles Dare, because that's what they were borrowing from.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point you're fighting, you know, Nazis with flamethrowers. So what's going to be wrong with that? That's great.
Yeah.
So here, I don't know what the film was trying to evoke. I mean, you don't put Robert Redford in a film like this that involves a conspiracy without wanting to kind of evoke a little bit of Parallax View, 3 Days of the Condor,
absolutely,
that kind of thing. That's sort of 70s paranoid,
right,
thriller.
Right.
But it didn't really come out. It just seemed to be a film about itself and its weird little mythology.
Interesting. How Matt, what did you think of Captain America 2?
First of all, the Winter Soldier, I feel like the Winter Soldier right now. I think it was pretty timely, all things considered.
It has been way too wintry around here.
It really has. Yeah, I thought it was a fun, diverting movie. It had a lot of weighty themes. Who can you trust?
Mm-hmm.
But they all sort of collided with one another. It was like the NSA one minute, the other minute it was, you know, childhood buddy.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a lot of trust issues and betrayal on every level.
Yeah.
That I think made it a bit of a muddle. But again, you don't look to a movie like this for thematic,
right,
coherence.
Right,
I think.
Right.
But it was satisfyingly fun. I think Chris Evans, to Glenn's point, he just sort of kind of disappears in this role. I'm not exactly sure, amidst this whole storm of themes that this movie involves, what Captain America is about or represents or what he learns at the end of the movie after he goes through all of this
mm-hmm,
stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How about you, Thompson?
Yeah, I think...
Other Thompson?
That's true. Yeah, we have multiple Thompsons here. No relation. Yeah, I think that one of the issues that people have had with Captain America in these movies in general is that he is the ultimate straight man. He's the Boy Scout. He is the unfrozen caveman soldier, you know, from a different era. And when you plop him into this movie, you can't really give him a lot of witty banter. You know, the funny things, the diversions, any kind of lightness in the film has to come from outside of him. And so when you watch a movie like The Avengers, there's just a million jokes. And this has all of the same kind of leaden action set pieces in all of these superhero movie after superhero movie. I mean, if you remember last summer, we were plotting through Star Trek Into Darkness and Man of Steel and Iron Man 3, and it felt like here's a floating aircraft carrier crashing into another floating aircraft carrier. You get all of that without necessarily any kind of pop and verve. And more to the point, I'm starting to find with a lot of superhero movies and action movies right now, where you have the bloat. This is almost 2.5 hours long. And there are all these conspiracies. Who can you trust? This shield. This person's been shot. This person, blah, blah, blah. And these movies start to become, in my head, a little bit indistinguishable as it's like a mystery. And the puzzle you're trying to solve is what the hell is going on? and so you're watching this whole thing, and you're just like, all right, they're here. Who? What? That? What? Wait, who's that guy? Wait, what did that guy say when I said who's that guy? You know? And in a sense, it's like, okay, it's somewhat engrossing. It's a mystery, but the mystery is just like, why am I watching this?
Now, see, here's the thing. I'm going to argue for this movie, and I'll tell you why, because I'm going to argue it is thematically coherent, and here's why I think it's thematically coherent. It is absolutely true, as Glenn says, that putting Robert Redford in this movie echoes these kind of 70s conspiracy thrillers, which the directors, the Russos, have talked about the fact that that's one of the things they were trying to evoke. It's one of the things that inspired them was these movies like The Conversation and 3 Days of the Condor and The Parallax View. And as soon as I started to actually look at this movie, I started to get those things a lot more. The entire visual center of this movie is this giant, tall shield building, right? Which is not actually in D.C. because D.C. doesn't have buildings like that. So it's across the river in Virginia. It has completely glass walls, giant glass walls, which means this huge, tall metal and glass building is constantly shooting these scenes of people scheming and engaging in various machinations and violence and things like that while gazing at basically the National Mall and the Potomac in this incredibly pastoral vision of D.C. And what made me notice it is you rarely see D.C. presented this way, mm-hmm. presented in this kind of really green, really rich, mm. kind of dreamy manner. Mm. And I started to feel like I was looking at beautiful postcards of D.C. all the time. And I started to think, why are they doing that? And what I started to think about was, if you're going to make Captain America, right, because we all know that when you sell a superhero movie now, you have to sell it internally, mm-hmm. you have to sell it domestically, and you have to sell it internationally. And I remember when they were first bringing out Captain America in 2011, they talked about the fact that Captain America can be a tough sell in China. Captain America can be a tough sell in Russia and some of these other emerging markets. And so to me, what began to emerge was this really interesting idea about kind of Americanism, where in most superhero movies, you get the superhero protecting America, in the case of Captain America, in the form of like a child, a farmer, a woman with a baby carriage. And what you get here is the protection is aimed at like old style Washington. So it's sort of the contrast is between big and tall shield building and pretty Jefferson and Lincoln memorials, so that Captain America is essentially protecting the old version of the government from the new version of the government, which has all these echoes of the NSA and things like that. So as I started to look at it, I thought there are all these kind of themes in this movie about the line, kind of the fine line between corruption versus infiltration, corruption coming from within and infiltration coming from without. And if you walk that line finely enough, you can basically tell people who have deep suspicions about the American government that this is all coming from within, right? This is the kind of corrupt government. And people who feel protective of the idea of America and Americanism and all this stuff as seen in Captain America believe that the problem is the infiltration of the American government by something that's external. So I actually began to think that it was a kind of more clever spin on how to look at what you make Captain America do and what you make Captain America about than I had originally thought it was before I started just being totally distracted by looking out the windows of that building at D.C., which you almost never see. There are these scenes where he's standing on a big dam and it's all water and trees. And every time he's having like a serious moment of emotion, he's surrounded weirdly by nature, which is very unusual. You normally get D.C. as this government buildings and people running around in the downtown. And here's the other thing. I'll point out one more small thing before I get off this wackadoo theory.
I don't think it's so wackadoo. I think you're doing a very compelling job.
of making this movie probably more than it is. I found out as I was researching this that although they did do a certain amount of location shooting in D.C., which I think is very obvious when you look at this movie, a bunch of what's supposed to be D.C. is actually Cleveland. And that's when my head kind of started to explode, because it's like in order to represent the America that Captain America is supposed to be protecting, they turned the Rust Belt into inside the Beltway. That's crazy. Like normally it would be Cleveland. It would be the heartland, and Ohio is sort of what Captain America would be all about. But they told Cleveland to pretend to be Washington to make it more America-y, which is not typically what superhero movies do. End of cockamamie theory.
All right. Not a cockamamie theory. I think you make a very good point. I still think, though, the execution, the themes are one thing. The execution here was kind of on rails. I mean, the twist in this movie, not to spoil it, but the twist in this movie is a testament to the fact that if you hire a graphic designer to design your logo, you make sure that he doesn't reuse it with another client to tweak it just a little bit. Because that's bad business. The climax of the film involves not one, not two, but three helicarriers.
Right.
One helicarrier in your movie is a dumb idea. It's one of those things from comics that looks cool, but is a pretty dumb idea. Three of them especially when you get into the actual what the villain wants in this thing, is just such it's a dumb idea.
Dumb idea
at the very basis.
And also,
film.
I mean, to speak to Chris Evans and Captain America's putative role in this process of inquiring what the nature of America is,
right,
and what it stands for and what it stood for and what should be protected and what have you. Where does Captain America stand at the end of the movie? What journey does he take is my question. He starts off very early in the film. You see him questioning his loyalty to S.H.I.E.L.D. and perhaps by extension or in addition, his loyalty to the government. At the end of the movie, where does he land?
But you are, I mean, to talk about the idea that in a superhero movie, the superhero is supposed to go on an emotional journey is a very, like, Nolanian version of superheroes, as opposed to the idea that...
And this is such an un-Nolan-y
It is such an un-Nolan-y
version
of this. And I think trying to make Captain America go on a journey. I mean, the most interesting journey of Captain America, I think, was that clash with Tony Stark that we talked about in The Avengers. But it's really hard to make Captain America go on a journey.
But even, okay, so I can't have the journey. Where does he stand at the end of the movie?
Yeah. I don't know. You're acting, you want more stuff shoehorned into that movie?
Stephen's like, the last thing I wanted was more about where Captain America
I wish that movie had been 2 hours and 58 minutes instead of...
No, maybe less stuff. Just tell me what Captain America is thinking.
It just felt very, you know, I don't know. And part of it is I'm on record as being weary of particularly the Marvel superhero movies that are all, they look like they cost about $280 million and they're all things crashing into things and cities, you know, having waste laid to them. And
but there's less laying waste to cities here.
There's a little
less.
There's a little bit less. There's there's some. but it in part because these are comic book movies and this is this gigantic interlocking story of all, you know, of these different components of the Avengers that they occasionally bring together in one super movie. I mean, I feel like now I'm on my like 28th hour of this story.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard for a movie like this, and the Avengers did it because it had so much wit.
Right.
You know, and I'm sure I'm an outlier. I'm sure this movie will make a fortune, but I'm weary of it. And by the time this airs, it's just begun to be April.
Yeah.
And I'm already like, don't make me see Amazing Spider-Man 2.
The shared universe is what sets these films apart, and that's what they're selling it to. They're not selling it to Joe Sixpack like, say, a Stephen Thompson.
They easily drink out of bottles.
Right,
that's cool.
Yeah. Right. The sip decorously from a atomizer. They're selling it to nerds because that's why in these movies, where's that end scene that comes right before there's two end scenes in this film, like there are in many Marvel films.
This is around the credits.
Yeah, around the credits. So, like, there's a first wave of credits, and then you get this extra scene, and it finishes with about one third of the audience going, and two thirds of the audience going, what the hell was that?
I stayed for this.
Right. It's true. Yeah. It's true.
Well, and a lot of times those cards are like, bad guy. Still bad.
Yeah, I know. Like the one,
it's not spoiling anything.
Yeah. So the one that ends this film at the very, very end, the one you have to sit through the entire soundtrack and everything is not worth sticking around for.
No, it's not.
Really
don't worry
not.
About the second one. Stay for the first one if you think you care. The second one is not important.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing, if I were going to stick up for the helicarriers, here's my theory of how the helicarriers fit into this. Are you
excited.
Ready?
I am excited.
Are you ready?
I have switched bodies.
All right. Okay. You got your 19th century, your 18th century, actually, vision of America, right, from the Jefferson Memorial, the Lincoln Memorial. You got your 21st century version from this shield building and the glass and steel and the incredible technology that they have. The helicarriers are Captain America's World War II heritage because the helicarriers are big and heavy and metal and could be battleships.
Mm-hmm.
So you wind up with him at the end returning to where he began, fighting in what look like World War II ships rather than anything particularly flashy or techie looking. And that's my theory of how the helicarriers fit into this entire thing. I've given it entirely too much thought.
Yeah.
I'm not going to lie.
I mean, I want to come back to another Linda Holmes theory from a previous discussion, which is the theory of all you really need to do is start your movie and say there's a box. Everybody wants the box.
Yeah.
The good guy is trying to protect the box from the bad guy mm-hmm. who wants the box. If you did that in this movie, it would be like 35 minutes long.
Yeah. Well, right. And the other thing is when you talk about those tag scenes, Stephen and I were talking about the fact that the tag scenes basically always consist of being like, there's another box. they just finished protecting the other box.
They thought they protected the one box. When they did not know about box number two.
All right.
Anyway, so you just now you are getting the opportunity to see Captain America. Feel free to come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH. And tell me to my face, it's okay, you can. You're thinking too hard. I won't mind. Anyway, speaking of thinking too hard, the other topic that we were going to talk about today, some of you may have already heard, obviously I have already heard and my friends have already heard, that NBC Universal announced recently that it is closing down a couple of websites, one of which is Daily Candy, which I also used to be part of, just in terms of receiving their emails about shopping and deals and cool stuff. But the other one is Television Without Pity. Now, my professional writing career, to just disclose my gigantic bias, began at Television Without Pity in 2001. I pitched them in 2000, and they were already fully staffed because I pitched a site that writes about television in mid-September. Bad timing. Incorrectly done. So I started writing for them the following year, and I wrote for them until early 2008, shortly after they were acquired by NBC Universal. So NBC is closing down on the day that this podcast airs, will be Television Without Pity's last day for the content, and then the forums will be going away at the end of May.
Now, Television Without Pity, for those who haven't seen it, long-form recaps of television shows, deep dives, and a pioneer in the recapping things on television world.
Sure.
Very, very oft imitated in its Television Without Pity's heyday. It was ground zero for a lot of like your very intense interaction between fans and the shows they love to hate to love, et cetera.
Exactly. So we were going to talk a little bit about you know, maybe the site a little bit, but also the fact that one of the things that came up was that they are taking the entire archives of the site offline. And it's one of those weird things where they say, you know, they'll still exist, we'll still have them. I remain hopeful that somebody will, I don't know, buy them or something like that, because it represents literally hundreds of thousands of pages of writing, if not more than that. You know, it really documents the early stages of this television and internet collision. And it represents, just for me, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, probably several thousand pages of writing. And it is a weird thing where, you know, it used to be that if you made your bones as a writer, you know, you would be in print and you would have a scrapbook and people still wouldn't be able to see your stuff all the time necessarily unless they went to the library.
Right.
But there's a weird expectation if you came up in digital writing, you can always kind of say to people, oh, yeah, you know, I wrote this thing in 2003 and here's the, you know, here it is and you can still read it.
Well, and as a writer, as a writer, you don't even necessarily save your manuscripts because you assume that once they're online, online is forever.
Yep. The only versions of that stuff that I ever had were Word documents that were all like formatted and they weren't edited yet and stuff like that. So it's not like I went through and took screenshots of the edited versions of these things. Not that I could have, because they were like 16 pages long and I wrote hundreds of them. So nobody would save that much of anything anyway.
And for fans, I mean, for me, the Television Without Pity recaps of Battlestar Galactica, Jacob Clifton's Battlestar Galactica recaps on TWA, as it was affectionately known, were part of my experience of binge-watching Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah. Yep.
The recaps, for some shows, I think recaps were just part of the experience of consumption. I think what was powerful about the site, in part, when it first came out, was that it kind of anticipated this way of watching television.
Yeah. Pick up on Stephen's point about the deep dive. These were deep dives. And
sometimes you mentioned Jacob Clifton deep into Jacob Clifton's brain.
Yes.
Yes.
But that's the thing. I mean, it's easy to forget that a site that was so funny, where the writing was so funny, took television seriously. That's what it set out to do, which was to create not an antagonistic relationship with the show per se, although sometimes that happened, but to say, okay, I dare you, or your job is to entertain, your job is to be a good show, here is where you're not doing it, and here's where you are. It's an ongoing conversation, even if the only feedback they got from some of the creators was sometimes on the forums, but sometimes just in the form of the show itself. It was an extended conversation, which is a different way, kind of dispensed with this idea that television is passive entertainment and made it something that you engage with in a different way, in a smart way. The Television Nut Pity produced a lot of great writers. It also produced, it popularized the concept of snark, which is a word that I think the world would be better without, because it's a way of dismissing exactly what I'm talking about, that engagement, that wry, sometimes sardonic way of writing about a show, and that it's become this very dismissive epithet that a lot of really good writing gets dismissed with that word. So they have that to answer for.
Yeah, and I think that when snark became part of the kind of motto of the site,
yeah,
it did not mean the same thing quite that it means now. It meant kind of more... It just kind of meant wisecracking. Like, it just kind of meant goofing.
Yeah.
It didn't have that same kind of edge of meanness and dismissiveness, I don't think. Because when I saw that word taking on that meaning, I remember sort of thinking, that's not what I think we thought that meant
when I
worked there.
And we should mention by way of backstory that its tagline was spare the snark and spoil the network. Right,
right, exactly. Spare the snark, spoil the networks.
And, you know, I found something happening in the forums mostly, but sometimes in the recaps themselves, where they would react to a character's doing something as if the character were real. And they would gin up this anger. And I found that the people weren't talking about the fact that a writer made that character do it.
Right.
But they got so engaged on such a level. In a way, it's kind of like, you know, literary criticism, the death of the author, where there's no such thing as authorial intent. Only for something like television, script to television, which is committee written and corporate produced and doesn't just exist to sell you soap flakes, but sort of does, that rests on a certain familiarity, a certain formula. I would go into the forums and somebody would be talking about how that character was so mean, and it's like, why are we talking about this?
It was not that way for the Buffy forums. The Buffy forums were so mad at the Buffy writers.
And
Marty Noxon.
That's what I was going to say.
Right.
Is that
with a show like Joss Whedon, with Aaron Sorkin and Amy Sherman-Palladino for the Gilmore Girls recaps. I mean, they were huge.
Right.
But it happened with scripted television. Didn't so much happen with reality TV.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because I think it was both, right? There were definitely times when people got very attached to arguing about the morality of characters' behavior.
That's what I'm talking about.
It sounds weird if you assume that they're actually angry at the character, but sometimes it was just an excuse to kind of talk around the morality of, if you were talking about should Buffy have gone off with Angel or Spike, right? You're not really talking about that. You're talking about how should that kind of relationship be managed? How should that kind of man in particular be received in your life? So they're not just talking about that. They're using it as an excuse to talk about a lot of other stuff, which, you know, when I was recapping, it's like you don't necessarily care enough about that one thing to write about it for 16 pages. But it became, and, you know, Jacob Clifton's a great example, it becomes an opportunity to just talk about whatever the heck you want. It's kind of a blank slate. And one of the things that a bunch of the other writers and I have talked about as it's been winding down, it was a great training exercise to just kind of have the show you have to write about and the page. And you know that this is your thing. You don't have to come up with a topic. You don't have to come up with an angle. You just have to start writing. And it was great training for just start writing.
One of the things about TWAP that I'm going to miss most, actually, are the forums. We've mentioned them several times.
Oh, the forums were amazing.
They were such a huge part of that place. I found myself in recent years increasingly nostalgic for this age of the internet that was, where your primary mode on the internet was about going to places like TWAP and talking about things with strangers.
Right.
My internet has become so much more about friends and the people that I follow on Twitter and Facebook and what have you. It's become harder and harder to meet strangers and talk with them.
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends on how you use those things. And certainly Twitter has, you know, in some ways replaced a little bit more in-depth interactions and longer
message boards
where you're able, and there are still certainly lots of message boards on the internet. I've got a few thoughts on Television Without Pity, and one is the way it crystallizes something I've talked about in this show in the past about how I don't trust the cloud and like why I don't like to put my data and my information in the cloud, and why streaming as opposed to DVDs, I never quite feel right. These things are just constantly taken away. It keeps these things in the hands of gatekeepers who can't always be trusted. And the fact that, you know, if I put something on WordPress 3 years ago, it's still sitting there, but you have this entire business in which, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars were spent creating this content, or tens of dollars.
Tens of dollars. No, they weren't. They paid writers from the beginning all the time. They never didn't pay writers.
But, you know, the fact that that can be taken away and that people are left to scramble to preserve things that they always assumed would be there, I think is a harsh and important reminder about the ephemeral nature of the internet. On a more personal note, this podcast would not exist if it weren't for Television Without Pity. And we've, you know, talked about this a little bit in various online places and on Twitter and everything, but it really should be noted. My interactions with Television Without Pity took place largely in the year 2004. And near the end of 2004, I was massively burned out and lying in bed with my laptop on my belly, watching football and reading Linda Holmes's recaps of various reality television shows. And I for one, never connected to recaps of scripted shows. But I loved recaps of reality shows because they were these treatises on human behavior.
Totally.
And so Linda's discussions of human behavior just absolutely fascinated me and kept me watching shows I wouldn't have otherwise watched. And so I'm lying there at the end of 2004, which was a year of tremendous strife and burnout. I had just left The Onion and was just lying around. And I so loved Linda's writing that I wrote her a fan letter. And that was the beginning of our friendship. This was before either of us had received a sniff from NPR. But our friendship, you know, over the years that followed is what made this show happen. We conceived of this particular show in my living room while drinking beer and talking. And that would never have happened if we hadn't met, and we wouldn't have met if it weren't for Television Without Pity. And you talk about these things that bring communities together, and you talk about how, oh man, I mean, I could go on a whole tangent about how online friendships supposedly being less real than in-person friendships. I mean, we would not be sitting here having these conversations if it weren't for that site and its wonderful writers. And we should shout out Sarah Bunting and Tara Ariano and Dave Cole, who made that site happen, because they created the pyramid scheme of joy that I talk about all the time. You create something, and then things are created because of it, and because of it, and because of it, and because of it, and it fans out.
Well, you hope so. And I think that you certainly loom the largest out of all the people that I met through that job. You're certainly not the only person that I met through that job. And, you know, basically a lot of the people who post a lot still here on the blog, a lot of people who comment a lot on the blog, a decent number of those people are people who come all the way from Television Without Pity, from those recaps, and some of them who I met at fan parties and stuff like that. There was, I think, an attachment to writers at that time that was a little more maybe permanent than what happens now. And those people were incredibly loyal. And there was a break between when I left there and when I came to NPR. And I really was very concerned that, actually, to be candid, my concern was that only the people who hated me would follow me from West. And it really worked out the opposite. People who had always been really supportive and really nice, you know, still showed up and came to NPR and kind of gave the blog and eventually the podcast a kind of a nut of an audience. And it's one of those things, like you say, the ephemera of the internet is a really very challenging thing. And when I think a lot about the content going away, not just my content, but everybody else's content, it's very bizarre to think all of the recappers I've talked to in the last week have had the experience of being like, I completely forgot I ever wrote that. Mm-hmm. Like, there are things where it's like, oh, that's right, I did recap two episodes of Trading Spaces. And I did recap that TV movie about Three's Company. And I did recap the TV movie about Donald Trump. And, you know, a bunch of other, an episode of Little House on the Prairie, a bunch of other, like, stuff that it's kind of, I know that eventually I will completely forget everything that I ever said about it. And it is one of those strange, sad things. But at the same time, like Stephen was talking about, what's more important is this sort of cascading effect where, you know, there are people who wrote for that site who work in television now. Mm-hmm. There's at least one person who works on Real Housewives who was a recapper. There's somebody who writes for Orange is the New Black who is a recapper. There are a couple of novelists who are recappers. There's me, if you want to count me. There's people who have done all kinds of different stuff off of that site. The women who do Go Fug Yourself met through being recappers at Television of the Pity. So, you know, there's a fairly significant kind of pop culture ripple from that site. And the nice thing is that all stays,
yeah.
You know?
It was part of, for me at least, I likened it. It was part of a constellation of sites that were doing really smart criticism at that time. One of which, every so often, at least once a year, I always go back to. And the last time, at least, that I checked, it was still there. It was Fame Tracker.
Oh, Fame Tracker, I think, is down.
Yeah.
I think they
no.
took Fame Tracker down.
No.
Fame Tracker was also Tara Ariano. That was Tara Ariano and Adam Sternberg,
right.
who now writes
yes.
for the New York Times Magazine. But Adam and Tara had Fame Tracker, which had the Hey, It's That Guy feature.
Two Stars, One Slot.
Two Stars, One Slot.
Galaxy. Of fame.
Yeah.
Ugh.
I wrote Hugh Jackman's fame audit.
You did?
For Fame Tracker, yes. I did. I wrote Hugh Jackman's fame audit. It was all about how he looked good in leather pants
and
in several different roles.
And we can no longer find that on the internet.
I think that's correct.
I might cry.
I think that's correct. And Adam's wonderful salute, O. Edward Norton, which was written as a poem about Edward Norton. And it was so good. Anyway, so, you know, as I said, I think this podcast is dropping on the 4th. If you have time, feel free to go read a recap. Think of me. I wrote a bunch of Amazing Race and Survivor and some early Apprentice and Big Brother.
Married by America.
Married by America. Stephen's favorite. And that brings us to our final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Well, first of all, the Wisconsin Badgers are in the Final Four.
Yes,
I just want to just soak it in for a moment. Our friend Margaret H. Willison. I feel like the proto-librarian who listens to this show.
It's true.
And a dear pal of ours mm-hmm. was on NPR over the weekend mm-hmm. talking about children's books.
She sure was.
My dream of turning pop culture happy hour superfan Margaret H. Willison into the new Nancy Pearl. That mission is on course.
She was wonderful.
And
she really was.
And she was wonderful and fantastic.
Not that we're surprised, but she was great. She sounded great. Uh-huh. She was great.
I just,
a lot better than the first time I did a two-way, I'll tell you that for sure.
Yeah, well, anyway, Margaret H. Willison on NPR, where she belongs. There is a new Patton Oswalt comedy album and special coming out called Tragedy Plus Comedy Equals Time, which will be rolling out in various forms. There's an album and a special and everything that will be rolling out as this show airs. And it should be noted, Patton Oswalt was in the Captain America screening.
He was.
Yeah, he was.
We all saw. I managed never to shriek at him and tear at his sleeves.
Yeah.
So who is the real Captain America?
It's
they call me Captain Restraint.
It's you, Steve.
And finally, I
call
just...
Call me Captain Restraint. Go ahead.
And finally, just a delightful little thing I love about the internet. I made a joke on Twitter today about the reunion of the group O-Town.
And just, man.
Yes, the group O-Town
is getting
back together. And I just made a slight little quip about it and was flooded with responses. Without Ashley Parker Angel, there is no O-Town. And I just, the fact that the reunion of O-Town had sparked outrage just made me so happy. It just, I don't know.
But it's true, though. Any group without Ashley Parker Angel is
no
O-Town.
I feel like I'm living in the right world.
Thank you, Stephen Thompson. We're all living in the right world with you. Matt Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
So a video game has been making the rounds of the internet called 2048 recently, which is pretty fun. It's pretty addictive. You'll probably finish it. I mean, you'll at least become a little bit bored with it pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So the game to go to after you quickly become addicted to 2048, play it for longer than you think you will and want more of the same buzz, is a game called Threes.
Oh, yeah.
That was the original iPhone and Android app that is actually more complicated, more interesting, and once you figure out 2048 is more like a teaser for Threes.
Yeah.
And it's got little characters.
And it's got little characters. It's very cute.
So what's it about?
So it's very simple. It's just a 4x4 block grid of numbers. And if you're playing on the web, you just press the arrow keys to move the numbers around. And as they collide into each other, ones collide into other ones and become twos. And twos collide into other twos and become fours and stuff like that. Like numbers all collapse into each other and multiply. And the goal is to keep these numbers moving around the board for as long as you possibly can until reaching 2048, the number 2048.
The number 2048.
Right. Yes.
It sounds suspiciously like math.
It does the math for you,
yes.
Let's say.
Yes.
And B, threes is superior to 2048.
Yes.
Because when you put two numbers together and you form a number that you haven't formed yet, the little character says hey to you, the little character you create. Because each character, each number has a different character. So it's like, hello. Hey. Fine. They all have different little personalities. Uh-huh. It's awesome.
And the rules are also slightly different for threes and 2048. But 2048 is a good sort of like, ooh, snacky sampler.
So 2048 is making you happy, but threes makes you even more happy.
Yes.
Thank you, Matt Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
So many things have been away a week. So lightning round. You know how you go to we see friends and everybody's talking about that one television show? It used to be True Detective. Before that, it was Breaking Bad. What's the one today? What's the one? I ask you. The Americans.
Yeah.
The Americans is a really good show. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, of course, set in the 80s about the Soviet spies in America. And I heard the Slate Culture Gabfest talking about it. And Stephen Metcalf said something very smart. He said, it's really a show about a marriage. And I thought, that's really a brilliant insight. And then I went to the Wikipedia page where the guy says, this show about a marriage. So he's still smart. And I'm sure he didn't steal it. But it's great. Cosmos. Okay. Cosmos is on right now. And it's great. Yeah. And, you know, Neil deGrasse Tyson works better on Colbert, where he's just talking, and this gives him things to say, which are a little stiff, and he's not quite in the zone yet, but man, the show's good. Here's something I'm not going to recommend the full thing is, but my pal, the brilliant writer Nathan Englander, was on The Real Housewives of New York.
I know. I heard that.
In a party scene, I don't know the show, so one of the shrieking Harridans on the show hosted a party for Nathan's friend, and there he is on the thing. So I had to send him like a screen cap, and to get the one that I wanted where he looked the stupidest, I had to watch the stupid show over that just to hear that one scene and see these horrible people talking about this scene where she talks to her publisher and it's just the worst. Anyway, but Broad City is another show I wanted to recommend because it is so good. I said before that it's Girls with Jokes, which is not fair to girls. Girls is a great show. But this show is so smart. These characters can act like idiots, but we're laughing with them because we just love these characters so much and they love each other. It's just a smart, really, really funny show on Comedy Central. And finally, the show that you've just about missed because I think it's going off the air, Enlisted. Enlisted is a really smart show.
I think it's already
Fox.
Off the air by the time we see this, but it's probably on Hulu.
It's on demand, and you should just catch up on it because this is a show with great jokes, great acting, and great characters, especially the character of Randy, who is easy on the eyes.
Yeah, I like that show too. It was very sad that they did not treat that show a little better than putting it on Friday night.
Friday night. There was not a time for that show. So Americans, Cosmos, Nathan Englander on Real Housewives. Zip through it. Broad City and Enlisted.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon, for the bounty of things making you happy. So if you want to know why I all of a sudden am doing this bizarre thing where I'm like, these scenes in the Shield building look kind of like those scenes in the Parallax View. It's partly because I have been watching this series called The Story of Film, an Odyssey. It's narrated and was made by an Irish dude, and it's on Netflix. And again, The Story of Film, an Odyssey, it's called. And what it does is it's a 15-hour, so 15-part series that aired, I think, originally on television in the UK, where he goes through the entire history of film and he has, you know, access to clips of everything. And he shows the development of filmmaking, the development of cinema. He's not at all centered around American or British or English-speaking or even kind of classical European, you know, fancy pants movies. He talks a lot about Arab filmmaking, about African filmmaking, about Asian filmmaking. And he goes just a little tiny bit at a time through the entire history of film. It's really fun, of course, when he says, you know, this movie from the 1960s, this shot is based on this, you know, Kurosawa shot or whatever. He'll show you both. And it is really fascinating when he does that. But what it really does is it limbers up your brain to think that way about movies. It's not so much just the information that's imparted. This is influenced by that. That's influenced by this. This is the piece of vocabulary to talk about this effect, although that's all really cool. It's that it starts to make you think in different ways about how things connect to other things and how they remind you of other things and what the purpose is of showing a building in a particular way or what the purpose is of shooting a character in a particular way. So if you want to know why I was gassing on endlessly about my theory of Captain America, that's why.
And it's tweeting a shot from Captain America that you compared to a shot from Top Gun.
Correct.
Right.
That is right. That's part of why I was kind of in this, I've been in this headspace for the last few weeks, is that I've been making my way through this really, really wonderful series. And like I said, it's on Netflix streaming. So if you have Netflix, you can just go and watch it. The Story of Film and Odyssey. It's really super wonderful. And I have been enjoying it enormously. It is progressive in the ways that you would find interesting. It puts tons of context around things. It talks about, you know, movements in film as they relate to each other. I love it. It's completely, completely brilliant and riveting. And it will make you spawn weirdo theories about Captain America.
If it makes me think and talk more like you, Linda Holmes, I'm already sold.
Well, that's very sweet.
So so what you're saying is that had I watched this series, my reaction to Captain America would have been more articulate than...
No, it just would have been probably more thinking too hard, such as me. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPRMonkeyC. You can follow Stephen at IDislikeStephen, S-D-E-P-H-E-N. You can follow Matt at MTOMPS, right?
Yes.
M-T-H-O-M-P-S. You can follow Glenn at G-H Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. That's R-E-E-D-Y. You can follow our also producer, Nick Fountain, at Nick Fountain. Nick, like Nick. Fountain, like Fountain. You can follow our esteemed music director and producer emeritus, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music, which you are bobbing your head to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you, Captain America, for being so beautiful. And thanks to all of you for listening. We will see you back here next week. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. If you are looking for something new to listen to, there are lots of other NPR podcasts. There are great interviews, highlights from the week's news, storytelling, and entertainment. And you can browse them all on iTunes under podcasts.